Welcome to the video podcast, Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, where truth and unity matter. Take the deep dive with highly influential voices in and around the 9/11 truth movement.
And welcome back, everybody. Hey, that wasn't supposed to happen. How about that? Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed at your service. We're so excited today to bring on our guest, Graham McQueen. I mean, every time I have Graham on, people clamor for more of him. You know why? Because he's so widely read. I mean, he reads, he researches, he writes, and there's so many things we can do. We're already going to have him back in March. And guess what? Even more so, we're going to have him back in he doesn't know this yet, but he's going to be talking about anthrax. And that's yet an additional subject. Before that, though, before I bring on my esteemed guest, I want you to say hello to Gail. Hello, Gail.
Hello. Hello.
Can you believe the guest we have today?
Oh, my gosh, this is going to be really good. They're all really good. But yeah, very exciting because you know what? Eyewitnesses are so important and they're irrefutable. You know, what somebody sees with their own eyes and they're not under the influence of anything, or, you know, they know what they saw. So
I'd wager that it's the most potent weapon we have against the deep state, which we will be talking about tonight. Can you believe that?
Awesome. Good.
The deep state. We didn't do that over at AE 9/11 Truth for good reason. But now I'm unleashed. And for those of you who want to know what that means or what that's about, you need to visit the website and you can learn a whole lot more about my flying solo from AE 9/11 Truth. Yeah, 3 months ago. Visit richardgage911.org for the whole story. And there's a podcast on it. There's a letter from me, and there's more information you can learn about the effort there and what we're doing and how we can do podcasts like today's podcast. Which ventures outside of the narrow box that I've been constrained within for 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's kind of nice, but uncomfortable to stretch my wings and cover some of these other subjects. And guess what?
What?
We decided today, on this day, that we're going to host a conference on the Pentagon.
Yes.
Yep, I'm dipping my foot into that one too, and I may lose it, but you're coming with me, right?
Oh, absolutely. And everyone else, right?
Yeah, we're going to drag everybody into this with us. We will invite at least the three major players in the Pentagon set of issues, the major themes or theories, and lots of evidence too. So we'll get more on that. But Gail, you've got some exciting announcements here.
I do. And I just wanted to remind everybody, especially those of you that weren't able to make it to join us on Tuesday's podcast. We had Tom Sullivan. He's a CDI, Controlled Demolition Inc. It's a company that does controlled demolition. He was one of their loaders for the explosives. Awesome. It was just a great podcast, great interview. So if you didn't get a chance to see it, yeah, go back and find it on one of the social media platforms and watch it. And then next Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, we have Ricky DeSantis, and he is an eyewitness, saw one of the planes flying into the building. He was standing right underneath it, and he looks up and there's the plane. It flies into the building. Just like that.
Yeah, just like that.
Yeah. And so he also the explosion blew him backwards, I guess, and just really injured him badly. So he's on next Tuesday. And then Thursday, we have Fran Scher, and she is a psychotherapist who is going to be, and I want to give it away or be a spoiler, but she's going to be discussing from a therapist viewpoint, the parallels between 9/11 and that horrible disease that is going around.
Yeah, we're stepping into that one too, aren't we, Gail?
Yes, and she's an awesome person.
I'm going to let her step into it.
Yeah, that's right. You're interviewing her, and she steps in. Yeah, and then
see, hands off.
Yes, I see. We're also branching out and going up on a bunch of new platforms that we have discovered. And I'll just read the list real quick. Some of you might be familiar with them, but there's a lot that I didn't know about. And I guess they're becoming more and more popular with all of the really terrible censoring that's going on our social media platforms, the main ones. And a lot of these are sort of like a copy of the real popular ones. You can tell by the names, very similar. So we are actually on, I think, all of these now. We're just working on building up the platform with the profile content and all that. So Odyssey, Brightian Social, BitChute, Minds, and that's MINDS, like your mind. Float, which is F, like in Frank, FLOTE. Rockfin, Parler. Most of you are probably familiar with Parler. They were down for a while. They're the alternative to Twitter. And GabTV, of course, is YouTube. Sovereign, which is Ben Swan's new platform. We're really excited to be on his platform. Mm-hmm. NewTube, which is obviously YouTube. Rumble, most of us are familiar with Rumble. And then, of course, you know, our usual Facebook, three different Facebook and Twitter. LinkedIn has two or three. And YouTube.
Speaking of which, that's where people can ask questions if they have any for our guest, right?
Yes. So the Facebook platforms and YouTube and LinkedIn also. Underneath the video, there's a comment section where you can comment, and go ahead and put your questions there. Type in your questions, hit send, and I gather the questions on my little computer here, and I'll bring them over and read them to our guests so the guests can answer your questions. So Graham will, I know, very much look forward to answering your questions.
Fantastic. And you'll come back and bring those questions to us, right?
I sure will. Yes.
Okay. Well, until then, we'll catch up with you. Okay. Gail will be reading your questions in the background, and she'll be talking to you too online.
Yeah.
All right?
Yep.
Thanks, Gail.
You're welcome.
My lovely wife and assistant. Boy, does she work like a horse around here. There's so much to do. I can't possibly do not even half of it. She comes home from full-time work and works with me at night and on weekends. Yeah. The reason I say that is because you can make that happen to an even greater degree by supporting us. Click one of those buttons on our website, RichardGage911.org, and you can support us at $7 a month. Very important. This is not optional. This is something that you need to do, whether it's for free, because there's a free version there too, or supporting us at the $7 a month level, or $70 a year. It's quite a discount. Or $300 a year. That's an even greater discount for those of you who see discounts the way I do. Thank you. And Gail, we'll see you real shortly.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. And guess what? I've got something to share with you, and that is this. Why are the 9/11 eyewitnesses so important? And what do their accounts reveal about the destruction of the Twin Towers? What was our government's response to the 156 first responder witnesses of explosions, and who dug through the 500 first responder testimonies in the oral histories to find those 156 first responders talking about explosion? Hint, it was my guest and what was the response to the coverage of explosions from the 36 TV reporters that day? Yeah, 36 TV reporters reporting explosions. How can the eyewitnesses pave the way to truth in such deep state events? What did the testimony of 50 eyewitnesses reveal about the JFK assassination? How were they treated? And the witnesses of the RFK shooting? What are the patterns that develop across these deep state events, including 9/11 and the current COVID, you know what? And what do they reveal to us about our government, most importantly? My guest is the consummate 9/11 researcher, Professor Graham McQueen, who was relentless on the global war on terror as a critic. He's a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel, and he's been co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. He was on the organizing committee for the 2011 Toronto hearings about 9/11. Graham has also written numerous articles on the events of 9/11, as well as the book 2001: Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. He also produced the most detailed study to date of the 2014 shootings in Ottawa, Canada, which have been used as a pretext for undermining the civil liberties of Canadians. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to my wonderful guest, Mr. Graham McQueen. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Richard.
Here we are.
It's great to see you. Great to be here. Great to meet Gail.
I'll say, and she feels the same way, having talked backstage just a little bit. Graham, let me start with the question. How did you become aware of what really happened on 9/11 and when?
Well, I haven't done a detailed thing, but I became aware pretty quickly after the events that there were some people who questioned them. And since I'd already been involved in peace studies for years, and I was aware of state deception and war triggers and all this stuff, I did not dismiss those people. At the same time, I felt I didn't have time to stop and do the research. I was an activist. I wanted to stop the invasion of Afghanistan. We failed. I wanted to stop the invasion of Iraq. We failed. And finally, after that, I kind of paused and said, okay, I need to look into this. So I didn't look into it seriously till 2005. And then all, you know, that was the turning point in my life, really, because I've spent much of the time since then studying this. I've been involved for a long time studying war and peace issues, but this specific study of state deception, you can say state crimes against democracy, you can say the great crimes of the deep state. All of these terms are helpful. But in any case, I concentrated on 9/11, but then I realized that the anthrax attacks were strangely fishy attacks too. And the more I looked into them, the more I realized they were directly connected to 9/11. And there were all kinds of books out about the anthrax attacks, some of them very big, very scholarly. But all the authors, with the exception, I think, of one German author, assumed the official story of 9/11 was true. And I became convinced that they had never solved the anthrax attacks under those assumptions. It couldn't happen. You had to understand 9/11 was a fraud in order to understand that the anthrax attacks were a fraud and that they were done by the same people. So yes, there's a picture of the book, came out in 2014, and there have been one or two developments since then. But I could tell you lots of details about my autobiography, but I don't know if anyone's interested. So if you like, I can talk about how I get into the study of the eyewitnesses per se.
Well, that is the major piece that that helped me so much, because I've been showing evidence assembled, almost all of it by others, or I assembled it, I guess, into one cohesive whole well, three cohesive wholes in the presentations that I do: Building 7, the Twin Towers Explosive Destruction, and then the Twin Towers in Extreme Heat. And it's that part two piece that I have relied on you so much for, and especially these eyewitnesses, these first responders. How did you get into that, and how did that develop?
Right. Well, I remember that one pretty clearly. In 2005, I started to get into the 9/11 issue quite deeply. I was extremely curious. And as I began to read seriously on the issue, I thought, my God, this really does look like a fraud. And then I read an article as it came off the press, hot off the press, by David Ray Griffin, called something like Explosive Testimony. Mm-hmm. And it was about firefighter testimony, based on research that was good research, but partial. They had noted that the World Trade Center Task Force report had come out because the New York Times had sued the city of New York, and that this World Trade Center Task Force report was, I don't know, 10 or 12,000 pages, and included the testimony of about 500 members of the Fire Department of New York. And basically what David was saying, David Ray Griffin, was some of these firefighters very clearly talk about massive explosions in the building. So this is a really important document. And I thought, well, not only that, but I'm in a really good position to carry this research further. I mean, I've recently retired from the university at that point. I had my data myself. I had projects I was doing, but this was so important, I just swept them all off my desk. And I said, I'm going to read this damn 12,000 pages. I'm going to read it immediately. I'm going to read it carefully, and I'm going to see what's in there. Now, you know, I had to read it all for the first time before actually figuring out what my methodology would be. You know, it's, some people say, oh, you should have just downloaded it all and done internet searches, you know, just kind of searching for the term explosion and stuff. No, you couldn't do it properly that way, because you had to read it and see what were the terms and expressions they actually used. It's not just explosion. They used the term blast. They used the term, you know, secondary device, bomb. And so after having read through it all, I knew what the key terms were that I needed to look for. Because what I wanted to do, Richard, was, first of all, not cherry picking. I don't believe in that. You don't just go through a document and pick out the stuff you like and ignore all the rest. You study the whole document carefully, and you say how many firefighters talked about explosions when they saw these buildings coming, and how many didn't, right? You ask that too. And so I did all that. And you try to come out with a comprehensive picture, and you try to quantify that in a way, if you can. People talk about it as soft evidence, eyewitness testimony. Well, in some ways it is. In other ways, it's extremely tough evidence. It's not easy to get rid of, not when you have this many eyewitnesses. You can't just sweep them away. And moreover, you can quantify it to some extent. So that's what I did. I said, I'm going to get a list of terms, you know, bomb, blast, blow up, explode, implosion. And I'm going to see how many people used those terms in describing what they saw right there at the scene as they witnessed the event. And that's what my report was when it came out in 2006. I didn't know what to do with it. First, I thought maybe I'll just post it on the internet. But at that point, there was a new journal out, the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and it was already attracting some good, solid articles. It was peer-reviewed, and it really was. And a lot of people say, ah, that's not a good journal. I was eventually invited on to be a co-editor, a of the journal, and I can assure you it was peer-reviewed, and I picked the people to peer-review it, and I corresponded with them. And before that, when I wasn't a member of the journal, I can assure you they peer-reviewed my article. They said, you know, this you got this wrong. You got to go through the documents again to look at this. You're not up to date on the NIST report. So, you know, I had to do all that before they would publish it, but then they did some point or other in the summer of 2006. It was not an immediate bestseller. You know, I kind of hoped, you know, it would blow the roof off everyone's heads, but it didn't.
It should have.
It took time to grow.
It blew the roof off my head because that was the first thing I came across by accident in the 9/11 truth movement. I was minding my own business, driving my van back to the office from a construction observation, and there's David Ray Griffin on the radio with Bonnie Faulkner on her show Guns and Butter talking about you and the research that you had done. At the time, it was 118 first responders on the first pass, right?
Right.
That you had found. And he was reading those off, and I'm going, I never heard any of this. In fact, I didn't even know a third tower came down on 9/11. The whole thing was blowing me away, so keep going.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's exciting, Richard. I didn't know I had anything to do with your Road to Damascus experience.
Yeah, his whole presentation or interview was on the single subject of the oral histories.
Okay.
Of first responders, highlighting your work all the way.
Okay, well, that's really good to know. So it did have some. It did have some effect. Now, the way these things happen, you work away, you squirrel yourself away in your office, getting carpal tunnel and all, straining your eyes. It's not easy work. Eventually, you come out with this work, and you hope something will happen. For a long time, it doesn't. But eventually, yes, it became known, and the term 118 witnesses eventually became kind of iconic in the movement. I said to some guy once, why are there 118? I was just pulling his leg a little. Somebody at AE 9/11 Truth, and he said, I don't know. I said, well, I'm the guy that wrote the article. And he said, who's that? I don't know who wrote the article. Anyway, that's kind of funny. But it became a kind of a classic, an important piece eventually. So there was that. Then I did a bunch of other articles. I didn't just stick with eyewitnesses.
What do you think as the author now, a lot of years later, 13, 14, what was so important about that article?
Well, I think the methodology was sound. And the sources were sound. They were absolutely primary sources. These were firefighters interviewed by their own superiors in the offices of the FDNY. It was all tape recorded. We don't have access to that. But that was all then transcribed. So this is the horse's mouth, so to speak. These were people who were right there, and they were interviewed pretty quickly. And then in a few months after the events, starting in October, in fact, and there they all were, and I was careful to go through them respectfully. Doesn't mean I got every last thing. Someday somebody's going to come out and say he miscounted. But, you know, I did my best. And what I found was that there were, out of roughly 500 eyewitnesses, that is firefighters, in the World Trade Center Task Force report, there were 126 who said something of significance after having witnessed the buildings. In other words, they said something more than just, oh my God. And of that 126, 118 talked about explosions. Mm. And that makes 92%. Mm. And that means these guys were right in the thick of things. They were being covered by debris. They were fighting for their lives. They were losing comrades. You couldn't get any closer. And 92% of them were talking about explosions. And it's clear from what some of them say that it was just assumed at the time by most of them that the buildings had been blown up. It wasn't even controversial when they were there on the scene. Thank you. That that shows the gist.
And this is the document here that you used, is that right? That's the transcripts on the New York Times?
Yeah, so it tells you who it is, and then you click on and you get their testimony, and you go through it. And it's a slow process, but it's a very important document.
Yeah, and they weren't only finding explosions, right? What else were they saying?
I'm not sure what you're fishing for.
It's a leading question. apparently, there's a lot of them that saw flashes.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It wasn't just the sounds that there were sights. Yes, some of them saw very systematic flashes. Some of them saw, and they used actually gestures like this, successive explosions down the length of the building. And some saw the building being violently pulverized and ran for their lives. So there are several senses at work here. They are seeing what's happening, including the flashes. They are hearing what's happening. And some of them are very much feeling what's happening. You have it here. We felt the ground shake. All of a sudden, the ground started to shake. You have people saying things like, suddenly there was a monstrous explosion and the lights went out immediately. I was physically picked up and thrown across the concourse, slamming into a wall. That's a Port Authority police officer. It's really important to look at the details. So if somebody comes along and says, oh, it could have been anything. It could have been, you know, a body falling on the ground that they heard. It could have been a beam snapping. It could have been, well, they keep inventing things. It could have been an elevator crashing. Well, no, that doesn't pick up a policeman and physically in the air, throw him across the concourse, which is quite a distance, and slam him into the wall. It's clear that these were explosions and they were very large explosions. And when people say it could have been anything, and unfortunately, some of my academic friends have basically had that response, it's a lazy response because obviously it couldn't have been anything. You have to look into it and say, well, what are the options? What could it have been? And I did look into them, and my presentation at the Toronto hearings in 2011 addressed that. Basically, I came up with three categories, and they were, it's not written here, power, pattern, and identification. Oh. And what I mean by that is this. Some people clearly saw these explosions tearing these enormous buildings to pieces, and none of the usual explosions you would expect in a high-rise fire, you know, such as smoke explosions and backdrafts and blevies, boiling liquid, expanding vapor, an electrical fire. None of them could possibly do that with these enormous buildings. So that's the category of power. The second is pattern. We've already discussed it. Patterns of flashes going around the building, patterns of explosions coming down floor by floor. None of the normal things in a high-rise fire would do that. And thirdly,
Before you get to the third one, Graham, it seems to me in the pattern category, you have timing. And that was one of the things that struck me so much again and again in these witnesses. You see this order of events shortly before the first tower came down. Now, that's not the tower coming down and then making these noises or explosions. I remember feeling the ground shaking.
Yeah.
So feel, like you said, feeling the ground shaking, heard a terrible noise, and then.
Yeah.
And only then, debris just started flying everywhere.
That's right. I dealt with this in a separate article, the one on the South Tower coming down.
Oh.
And that's where I assembled all these lists of eyewitnesses because I found it very dramatic that they were standing there and they would say, I felt like an earthquake. I looked up and then the North Tower started to come down. Now think about it. As you say, obviously there's not debris hitting the ground at that point. there's not any massive destruction of the building at that point. Something else is happening, which is causing the rumbling in the ground. And this is the kind of thing we can learn from eyewitnesses.
Yeah.
And then
this one, it blows me away. All of a sudden, the ground just started shaking, felt like a train running under my feet. Mm-hmm. The next thing we know, we look up and the tower is collapsing.
Exactly. You know, these are very important testimonies. This is all from a separate article from the one we were discussing before, but they're both important.
I'm going to interrupt you one last time. This one just creeps me out. And then there seemed to be a momentary delay. That was after materials were shooting out horizontally, simultaneously from all four sides, before you could see the beginning of the collapse.
Yeah.
I mean, how much more clear does it get?
I completely agree. Let me finish my list of three.
If you're lucky.
No, I was going to say power, pattern, and identification. Identification just meant there were a lot of seasoned firefighters and medics who went into that building or those towers, and many of them had been in high-rise fires in New York before. And you would expect if these were normal explosions in a high-rise fire, they would say so, but they don't. They say this is very unusual, and in fact, I think it's 32 of them use a term either bomb or secondary device, which is the same thing, for what they heard going off. So they were signaling to us there that this was not normal at all. This is what you've got, Kenneth Rogers here, one floor under another. And when it hit about the fifth floor, I figured it was a bomb because it looked like a synchronized, deliberate kind of thing. So there are ways we can study these testimonies to rule out this glib phrase, it could have been anything. It could not have been anything. It could only have been very powerful explosions, which I believe must have come from pre-planted explosives in the buildings.
Agreed.
Wow. So where next? Where did we go next?
You have 118 of these you found in 2006.
Yeah.
What happened to cause you to revisit this and read those 12,000 pages yet again to come up with 156?
Well, I returned to eyewitnesses periodically. For example, I had to read the whole 12,000 pages again when I wrote an article on World Trade 7 because I wanted to pick out all the eyewitnesses who clearly had foreknowledge of that building coming down. People who would say things like, we were standing around for an hour. We were told this building was coming down. So we just hung out for an hour waiting until finally it came down. I mean, you know, so I had to go through the whole bunch of stuff again to do that. So I don't know how many times I've been through it.
Yeah. Well, that was with that foreknowledge, how were they told? I mean, you did a whole essay on this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
For those who don't know what we're talking about, Building 7 is the third skyscraper that came down on 9/11. It wasn't hit by an airplane. Most architects and engineers know nothing about it, though it was the third worst structural failure in modern history after the Twin Towers. So after witnesses hear explosions yet again, and I'd love to have you analyze those witnesses if you haven't, Graham, the building comes down after the witnesses hear the explosions. They see the building coming down yet again and smoothly, symmetrically into its own footprint in under 7 seconds. And that's a whole subject of another presentation, which you can find at richardgage911.org. But Graham, what did you learn about these first responders? What were they told?
My main focus when I did the article on seven, it was called Waiting for Seven. That's the title of the article. And it was published in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And I gave a presentation on it at the University of Hartford, which I should have written up, but I never did. Anyway, here's the gist. There were all kinds of people. There were hundreds of people who'd been told that that building was coming down, even though its utter collapse was completely historically unprecedented. No building like that, as you know, had ever come down fully from fire alone. So, you know, unprecedented does not go very well with foreknowledge. How on earth could they have known? And I explored, you know, in my talk at Hartford, various different kinds of foreknowledge and concluded this was the fishiest of foreknowledge. This wasn't like an astronomer saying, oh, there's going to be an eclipse in a week. No, because he knows that there's, he or she knows that there are regular movements of the planets and, you know, and so on. And so he can predict that. But this is an unprecedented fall of a building. Never happened before in history. And there was nothing obvious that was wrong with it apart from fire.
Well, and wasn't there an engineer who predicted that it would collapse in 5 hours? And what do we know about him?
Yes, I think it was about 5 hours. I think it was somewhere around noon when the engineer, who as far as I know, is still anonymous, went to the scene and looked at it and said, oh, you know, it's not plumb. It's going to come down at some point. And you know, I actually had a debate with Shyam Sundar, the big NIST guy.
I didn't know you had a debate.
Yeah, it was years ago, and I don't think anyone saved it. It was on a little Canadian radio station, and I was quite surprised that I was being invited to debate Sundar. But, you know, I pointed this out. I tried to be respectful. I didn't want to be nasty to him. But he wouldn't give an inch, you know. He just tried to say, oh, well, that there were all the signs were there that it might come down. They had heard a creaking sound, which they didn't like, and it, you know, it didn't look right. And I kind of, yeah, I really kind of went through that in the talk I gave in Hartford and showed how ridiculous that was. You don't conclude because a building has a creaky sound that it is going to come down quite precisely in this way at this time, which they did. You know, before it came down, they pushed the firefighters back. I don't remember how far it was, made them stand in a circle around the building. And as one of the firefighters says to us, and then it came down and the debris came just as far as they thought it would. So, I mean, this is really precise. We had guys blowing the horn and saying this building's about to blow up, get back. We had all that stuff. We had CNN predicting, or not actually predicting, saying that it was coming down. I think it was about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour before it came down. And we had the BBC saying this, making the same mistake 21 minutes before it came down. And it's all absurd. I mean, we don't have time to get into it. But basically, my point is, this is another case where eyewitness testimony is very important. I mean, obviously, there's other evidence that's important here, too. The whole physics of the thing, which has been beautifully done by many scientists. But, you know, there is room for all these eyewitnesses. How did they know these buildings were coming down? Where did that knowledge come from? How could they possibly have known? It's the fishiest of foreknowledge. It means it's the foreknowledge of an insider. That's what it is. The only way they could have known is because they were the ones who intended to bring it down.
And they were the first responders were told that it had structural damage and that it was going to come down. Is that true? Is that what they were told?
Well, let me see. There were people who said that about the Twin Towers too. We just got word that there's something wrong and they may come down. And the fire chief said, "Who the F told you that?" And subsequently, the poor man died in the collapse. Oh. But so we had it with the Twin Towers, and yeah, we had it with seven. There were all kinds of people. There were hundreds of firefighters, Richard, standing around waiting for the building to come down. So I don't know.
Where it finally comes down, and I guess people aren't surprised, except for people who weren't told.
Right. And in fact, you have it coming down on camera, and I think it's for hard for me to remember the names of the reporters and stuff. But anyway, the reporter says to the firefighter he's got there with him, "There it comes now. I guess you guys are just hanging around waiting for that to happen, weren't you?" And the firefighter says, "Well, yes, we'd been told that its stability had been compromised and it would either come down on its own or it would be brought down."
Well, brings us to Larry Silverstein, the owner of Building 7, having built it in the 80s, and then who acquired the rest of the complex in a deal that consummated just 6 weeks prior to 9/11.
Yes.
Regarding Building 7 on America Rebuilds, he says, "Well, I was talking to the fire commander. There's been such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it." Mm-hmm. And so they gave the order to pull, and we watched the building come down.
Exactly.
I would love to hear your thoughts on that quote.
Oh, well, I think he goofed. You see, Larry was a member of the deep state, but he didn't know when to keep his mouth shut. And I'm pretty sure he got a little phone call after that. Well, you know, Larry, how many kids did you say you have?
He got a lot of phone calls. People said, "What did you mean by pull it exactly?" A term used in the controlled demolition industry.
Yeah.
He says, "Oh, I didn't mean pull the building. I meant pull the firemen out of the building."
I know,
but it
I know.
Shown by FEMA that they were never in the building allowed
that's
to
right.
fight the fire at all, right?
No, that's right. It didn't make any sense. I went over that painstakingly back then because I was so determined to be cautious and not rush to judgment. Mm-hmm. But I ended up concluding he goofed. He gave it away.
Well.
So, you know, that's what...
Anyway, if you're talking about pulling the firemen out of the building, you
wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. No, I don't think that's what it meant. I think it meant controlled demolition.
So he's a witness, too. And
yes.
An inadvertent eyewitness, right?
He's an eyewitness that the FBI chose not to investigate and interview on this subject.
Mm.
Which is it's just classic, really. Remember Vincent Salandria, who just died a year or two ago? Vince gave a wonderful talk in the 1990s, and it was such an important talk for me that I formulated what I called the Salandria principles after that. He had been one of the first people to speak out against the JFK official narrative. He was a lawyer, and Vince said in his 1990s talk, "Let us not keep arguing forever about the details of what happened in Dealey Plaza, you know, on November 22nd, 1963. Let us ask the following question. How would an honest government that truly wanted to find out what happened, what would a truly honest government have done? For example, what would they have done with the Grassy Knoll witnesses? Well, they would have collected them all, and they would have carefully interviewed them all. Did they do that? No, they did not. Therefore, they were not an honest government seeking the truth." And I want to apply that principle to 9/11. Mm. If an honest government seeking truthfully to find out what happened on 9/11 had been in operation, what would they have done? Well, they wouldn't have waited for this nut, Graham McQueen, to collect all this stuff. They had the documents. They had the resources. I didn't have anything they didn't have. They would have sat down. They would have counted all these eyewitnesses, and then they would have gone to them and interviewed them, right? And they would have talked to them. They would have tried to sort out what happened. So did they? No, of course not. They didn't interview them. They dismissed them. The 9/11 Commission report has one line in an 800-page book in which it tries to dismiss all these witnesses. And NIST doesn't even bother mentioning their existence, mm-hmm. even though its job is to figure out why these buildings came down. So the whole thing immediately tells you that we're not in the hands of a trustworthy state. And I'm going to argue that we're not in the hands of a democratic state, because it seems to me that a fundamental principle in a democracy should be that every citizen, born equal and free, has the capacity of reason. And here I'm paraphrasing Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, has the capacity for reason and conscience. And I would go further and say, and they have the capacity to perceive the world around them. Every citizen, especially of a democratic state, has that. That's the assumption on which democracies are built, that we see what's going on around us, we perceive through our senses, we make judgments, we use our reason, we then employ our conscience, and that's how democracy is supposed to work. So, if that's the case, what do we conclude when eyewitnesses are either ignored or dishonored or shunted aside in some way, up to the point of even being killed in some cases, being dishonored, getting their jobs lost, threatening them in a whole variety of ways? Well, we conclude that whatever's going on, it's not the government that is at work at that moment is not a democracy. So then, if you'll pardon me for going on this philosophical thing for just a couple more minutes, if it's not a democracy, what is it? Well, it's acting as an oligarchy, which means rule of the few, not rule by the people. And it's operating because in an oligarchy, it is assumed that there's a smaller number of people who have the intellect and the perception and the wisdom and the power and the right to rule everybody else. And that's what's acting here. So from that point of view, it doesn't matter how many eyewitnesses there are. They're rabble or they're cattle. You know, they don't count. They don't perceive properly. They don't think properly. So we, the authorities, can ignore them all. And this is where the deep state comes in, just before you let me go on this. The deep state is a term that's used in different ways by different people, but I use it to mean what you might call the modern version of an oligarchy. See, in the old days, there were all kinds of oligarchies, and they didn't apologize for being an oligarchy. They said, of course we're an oligarchy. We're the best people. We're going to rule you. But in the modern period, democracy has achieved very high credibility. And everybody either pretends or tries to practice democracy. So what happens? It means that oligarchies have had to go underground. And that's what I mean by the deep state. I mean an oligarchy that has gone underground. So it is covert and complex, but it's still there. The image of the iceberg comes to mind, where you see a little bit on the surface and you don't see this huge thing, which is the deep state under the surface. So people think, we've got a democracy. We have elections. We can petition for this and that. We have grand juries. We have all this stuff. We can demonstrate. We have certain rights. But the deep state does not respond to any of those things. It is an enormous, it's a collection of enormously powerful institutions and people. They are essentially lawless. As we see them breaking through the surface in the events we're talking about today, we see them as lawless, as extremely violent, and as having no respect for the people they are annihilating, whether it be in New York City or in Iraq. So we're talking about a very vicious beast that's lying under the surface here. And that's part of the reason I think many people don't want to acknowledge that it's there. They felt cuddly feelings about their government. They put their hand on their heart and oaths of allegiance, and some of them went off to fight and risk their lives in foreign fields for this government. And then, and believe me, I know some of those guys who went off to Vietnam and who are now just filled with rage as they see what their government is doing with things like 9/11 and other similar deep state events. So when I talk about eyewitnesses and the deep state, which was in the original title of this talk, what I mean is this. The deep state has no respect for eyewitnesses because the deep state is an oligarchy gone underground, and it feels it has the right to rule. It perceives, it rules, it decides, it thinks. Nobody else does. And so when the deep state breaks through to the surface in the JFK murder or the RFK murder or in 9/11, we begin to see its nature. Lawlessness and violence, and of course, profits to be made. And I find, and I became interested in the wider issue of eyewitnesses after I did the 9/11 stuff. Because here's what happened. I compiled all this these 9/11 eyewitnesses, and I got 118, and then I got 156. And some people were kind of cheering me on. Keep going, keep going. Maybe you can make it to 200. This could be your life's work. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. I may have a few years left here. Do I really want to spend it on continuing a list which has no particular significance? By that, I mean, if people aren't convinced by 156, why would they be convinced by 200? So I had to ask myself the question, what's really going on here? And that's what led me to these other considerations. What's going on here is that at the moment when this event happens and in the moments after, the days, the weeks, the years after, we do not have a functioning democracy. And that's why eyewitnesses can be treated like cattle. So these are deep state events. And that's why I wanted to look at the RFK and JFK assassinations to see if they were patterns. And I must give credit to Lance DeHaven Smith. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were there when Lance gave his talk at the Toronto hearings. Yep. He's written a book on conspiracy theory in America, by the way, a very good book. But he said, don't just look at one event. He called them, he didn't call them deep state events. He called them state crimes against democracy. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. But he said, don't just look at one. You have to discover the patterns. He said, so many people talk about the JFK assassination and they've never bothered to look at the RFK assassination, but there are common patterns. You need to perceive the pattern. And I took that seriously. And so I thought, if my subject is eyewitnesses, and it makes sense that that be my subject, I have no scientific training that would lead me to study the physics of something, then let's look at it. And if you have the time, I'll mention a couple of those here.
Oh, please. Please, some examples, yes.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, we still haven't talked about the 9/11 thing, research project that Ted and I did, but maybe we can come back to that. Shall we go on?
I want to hear your examples.
Okay.
About JFK and RFK, and then we'll go on to the 36 reporters. I've got that queued
up. All right. Okay. All right. So we go to JFK. What do we find? Well, there's all kinds of eyewitnesses to important things, but the most famous ones are the people who thought that there was one or more shots from the grassy knoll. Why is that important? It's important because according to the official story, there was one shooter, Lee Harvey Oswald, and he was located, in a sniper's nest on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building. Now, I quickly realized as I began studying this that if there is even one shot from any other place than that sniper's nest, then the whole Warren Commission report falls to the ground. The Warren Commission report was committed to the lone shooter and was committed to not finding a conspiracy. And they used the term conspiracy. They said, you know, it was one of their big conclusions there. No evidence of a conspiracy. Well, if there were two shooters in Dealey Plaza at that precise moment, and one was over here and one was over here, then obviously they had talked to each other before, they had planned the crime, and there were two or more of them, and that is what a conspiracy is. So the fundamental conclusion of the report was false. And I looked into it a bit. I mean, let me tell you the history of this. In 1965, Harold Feldman drew up a list of 51 witnesses to shots from the grassy knoll. That's way back in 65, three years after. Yeah. And he mainly used the 26 volumes appended to the Warren Report. I don't know if you know about those 26 volumes.
No, I don't.
Okay. So when the Warren Commission published its main report, which is a book about, as I recall, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 pages, big book, it also decided to publish as a kind of appendix 26 volumes of evidence that they had used to reach their conclusions. Now, it seems they didn't think anyone would read would actually read those volumes. Nobody would be that – I'm sure nobody on the commission
– kind of like the 10,000 pages in the NIST report.
Well, it is, yeah. They're very parallel issues. So these 26 volumes were unindexed. They were chaotic. Oh, they were difficult to get hold of. But guess what? Harold Feldman got hold of them, and Vince Salandria got his copy, and Mark Lane and Sylvia Marr, all these great researchers got hold of them. And Harold Feldman went through them, and that's how he got his list of 51 eyewitnesses. So he used their own material against them. Wow. And then the year after that, 1966, Mark Lane published his famous book, Rush to Judgment, which everybody should read if they haven't. And he found that there were even more than 51 grassy knoll witnesses because he looked further. He looked into newspapers and FBI reports and interviewed some people himself and so on. Now, it's not a competition between the grassy knoll reports and the Texas School Depository reports. Some people saw, because it's clear the president was lured into a crossfire. There were people shooting him from different directions. And it's quite possible there was a shooter in the Texas School Book Depository building. I'm not saying there wasn't, but that's not the point. The point was that there was also a shooter, at least one, to the west of that location in that structure called the Grassy Knoll. Which is not just a grassy hill, for those who've never seen it. It's got structures on it. It's got a big picket fence, or at least it did at the time, with trees in front of it and a parking lot behind it. And when you actually see what it looked like at the time, you see that it would have been a perfect place to have hidden a shooter. And then he could have broken down his rifle and put it in the trunk of one of the cars, and that would have been it. Because the whole parking lot was under the control of the Dallas police, which had been corrupted by then and were participating in this event. So what do we learn from all this? There's nothing unusual about the fact that however many people, let's call it 50, heard explosions from a particular location. Some of them fell to the ground thinking the shots were coming from right over their head. Bill Newman and his wife and two kids were examples of that. They were very close to the president when he was shot in the head. They fell down. They said the shot seemed to come from right over their heads. Well, that wasn't the Texas School Book Depository. It was the Grassy Knoll. So if you actually look into this seriously and you read their accounts, which I've done, the eyewitness accounts, and you can even see some of them interviewed by Mark Lane in his documentary, which you can still find online. It's called Rush to Judgment by Mark Lane, and the director is Emil D'Antonio. It's a lovely documentary. There's no BS. It's not flashy. It's not color. There's no special effects. It's just people sitting there talking and interviewing each other. But one of the things I love is that Lane interviews a couple of these grassy knoll witnesses, and he even takes us on a trip with him and the camera to the grassy knoll. And the guy can say, this is where I saw the shot from, because I didn't just hear it. I saw the puff of smoke as well. It was right here. And it gives you a very lively sense of what that sniper location would have been like. So what does this mean? Okay, first of all, obviously, you can't dismiss those eyewitness evidence. Those eyewitnesses. So what does the Warren Commission do? It dismisses them. It does not even interview them all. Like Bill Newman, who was literally right there when President Kennedy was shot, fell on the ground with his kids and his wife. He was never interviewed by the commission. or by the FBI. So they didn't even make that effort. But secondly, after having done a number of interviews, some of them very leading interviews, by the way, just disgraceful interviews, you can read them there. And the guy will say, so you think it came from there, from over there, right? Yes, I do. But it could have come from over there, right? And this ordinary witness, you know, being interviewed by, let's say, an FBI guy, often will be battered down and say, well, I suppose it could have. It didn't sound like it. So anyway, insincere and highly imperfect interviewing of these people. No attempt to really get to the bottom of things. So we come to the same conclusion as we do in 9/11. This was not a true state inquiry. This is not how a democratic state investigates things. This is not how they treat eyewitnesses. And there were some eyewitnesses, not to the grassy knoll, but to other things, who also were threatened and even shot. So there was violent reprisal against some of them. Well, what's the conclusion? The conclusion is there is a pattern. You know, in these deep state events, the narrative being told to us by the deep state operatives like Alan Dulles, who Kennedy fired from the CIA, the narrative these people are telling us is a narrative they made up, and it is false. And it would rapidly be revealed to be false if we listened to the eyewitnesses. And it frustrates me a little that the term grassy knoll is used by some people today to indicate nuts and conspiracy theorists. Oh, you're out on the grassy knoll again, are you? But actually, the grassy knoll is the death of the Warren Commission. And after the publication of books like Mark Lane's in the late 60s, it's been shown that in surveys, the trust in government in the U.S. started to go down. Because they could see that their president, their beloved president, their popular president, had been murdered in public, and the Warren Commission had covered it up and lied.
Yep.
And nobody was doing a damn thing about it. And if you think particularly of the two Kennedys, Robert and Jack, both being killed, I think you can say that's a coup d'etat. Because Robert probably would have become president. And so the U.S. underwent something very much like a coup d'etat. That is a violent strike at government, which removes forcibly some people from office and puts other people in office in a way that radically changes the direction of the nation. And that's what happened. James Douglas discusses this beautifully in his book, JFK and the Unspeakable. Where he shows what was going on in John Kennedy's mind and shows his correspondence with Khrushchev and with Castro, trying to avoid nuclear annihilation, trying to work out, look, do we really have to be as antagonistic toward each other? Can we cool down the Cold War or warm up the Cold War, whatever you do to a Cold War? But there are people in positions of power. Alan Dulles, former head of the CIA, is a good example, but he's just one of a whole group who thought this young president was cheeky, that he had too much power for his britches, that he didn't come from the right side of the tracks, that he was putting the United States in danger, and they wanted to get rid of him, and if it meant shooting him in the head, they were darn ready to do it, and then put people in power who were willing to go in and have a big war in Vietnam and who were willing to keep fighting with the Russians and endangering the whole planet. These events, this coup d'etat in the 60s, didn't just influence the United States, it influenced the course of world history. And I think things could have gone so much better had those two men, the two Kennedys, stayed alive and had Martin Luther King Jr. also not been assassinated. It's another clearly inside job, which we won't get into here. So here's the thing.
Okay, but I want to have you take us to Robert Kennedy and talk about the witnesses of that shooting as well.
Yeah. So let's start with the physical evidence. So Thomas Noguchi is the coroner, and he makes sure a very careful autopsy is done after Bobby Kennedy dies. And it's not just an autopsy where you prod and you poke and you say what you see. He also goes and experiments. He does experiments because he wants to know for sure how far away the muzzle of the gun was when it was behind the right ear of Robert Kennedy for the final shot, because there's burn wounds and gunpowder and
powder burns.
Yeah, indicating close range. And he eventually concludes, and there he said he and his associates have given different distances at different times. But let's put it this way. Bobby Kennedy was shot at least three times from behind him and at an upward angle. The fatal bullet went behind his right ear, and the muzzle was positioned between a quarter of an inch and as far as 3 inches, though that's unlikely, from here. Now, why is that significant? By itself, it doesn't tell us too much. People are going to say, well, for heaven's sake, Sirhan was in the pantry, he had his gun, he was blasting away. Obviously, it was him. No, it's not obvious. You have to know where Sirhan was positioned with respect to Kennedy. And this is where the eyewitnesses come in, because the photographs taken of some of these events were confiscated by the Los Angeles police and presumably destroyed. So we have to count on eyewitnesses. And they don't put Sirhan in that position. For one thing, he was facing Bobby Kennedy, wasn't behind him, and he never got that close. Some of them say the gun may have been as close as 2 feet. Most of them say 3 or 4 feet. But none of them says that it was like an inch from the back of Kennedy's head. There's just a physical impossibility there. And we reach it through the forensic evidence, physical evidence, and the eyewitness evidence. We put them together and we reach the conclusion that Sirhan was there. Yes, he was firing away, but he did not hit Kennedy a single time. They were all from the back. And he did not kill him, for which he's been in jail for decades. And it's not too difficult to figure this out. And what does that mean?
That he was hearing voices and he seemed to be a mind programming victim too.
He may very well have been a mind programming person, and we don't know let's put it this way, whether he was firing real bullets or blanks. Lisa Pease gets into this somewhat in her book on the subject. I don't know if people want to know about books on the subject, but if you wanted to read about RFK, I would certainly... sorry, I'm looking here for the name of her book. Anyway, Lisa Pease, P-E-A-S-E, has written a very big book. And you can go into that book and you can see the eyewitnesses that I'm talking about, and what they said, and how far away they were, or how far away they thought Sirhan was. And could he have shot that close? No, he couldn't. And you get their names, you get their details. So there's nothing vague about this. You know, you can really nail it down. And I read that autopsy report years ago when I was wanting to know what happened with the RFK thing, and I was staggered. Because it looks like a very careful piece of work. And yet, somehow, this court goes and convicts. Well, it's my understanding that the autopsy report wasn't given to the defense lawyers until the last moment. And they decided not to introduce it into the case for various reasons. But what we've got is every year newspapers all over North America are saying this is the anniversary of the shooting of Bobby Kennedy and the killing of Bobby Kennedy by a Palestinian by the name of Sirhan. And I just groan every time. I think you guys are either so lazy, because it doesn't take that much time to sort this one out. You're really lazy, or else you're part of the problem and you're somehow collaborating. So what have we got here? We've got three cases so far, 9/11, JFK, RFK. In all cases, there's more than one kind of evidence. There's lots of physical evidence. I didn't even get into this in JFK. There's the analysis of the various wounds and where those must have been made from and so on. But we also have eyewitnesses, lots of them. And every time, they are treated as if they don't exist. It's important to remember that in most cases, there's no attempt even to give a proper answer to the eyewitnesses. I mean, the Warren Report, they just kind of draw themselves up and tighten their ties and say, we're strong, powerful, wealthy white men, and here's our verdict. We have found no credible evidence of any shooter from any other position but the sixth floor of the blah, blah, blah. Well, thank you. Yeah, you haven't analyzed any of these reports. You haven't explained why they're no good. And the same thing is true in the other cases, you know. So what does it mean? Well, my conclusion is it means that this is the radical demeaning of citizens of a democracy when they're treated as nothing. And it shows that there is a covert oligarchy at play and that those people think they matter and their views of the world matter and their perceptions matter and their brains think good thoughts, but everybody else can go to hell because they're actually repeatedly putting the world in grave danger through what they did. I mean, they killed John Kennedy and pretended it was a leftist who was, you know, sympathetic to Cuba. He'd lived in the Soviet Union. That could have triggered a nuclear holocaust, and it was all BS. We know Oswald was an agent of the U.S. That's why he went to the Soviet Union. He was an elaborate patsy. And again, what happened with 9/11? Did they just say, oh, it's too bad the towers were struck? No. They said, we got to go to war. Let's go hammer a few countries. Turn them into rubble.
And same with Vietnam. I mean, that escalation was fought by Kennedy.
That's right. And in Vietnam, they used the faulty Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was another fake incident, to ramp up support for that war. So there's a repeated pattern here. And it tells us how people are viewed by the deep state. It tells us what the deep state is capable of. And it should get us to think about what not only happened in the past, but what may be happening at present. Because at present, many governments of the world are being put under pressure.
And boy, is that true. Before we go there, does this pattern follow through with the TV reporters who were reporting on that day? Because they're witnesses too, right?
Right. Okay.
In addition to reporters.
Okay. So now we go to the TV reporters. So for a while, I thought that was the only guy in the world who cared about eyewitness evidence. And then Ted Walter, whom you know at Architects and Engineers, wrote an article about, eyewitnesses who were on television on 9/11. And so I contacted him and we decided to write an article together. And that's what you have. The article was officially called How 36 Reporters Brought Us the Twin Towers Explosive Demolition on 9/11. And you can find it on the website of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So how did that develop? Well, Ted and I were both aware of many little clips from here and there that had been flying around over the years from this television station and that television station, in which a reporter says, big explosion just went off. And those were useful, certainly, but we wanted to do better. We wanted to treat this evidence as important primary source evidence, just the way I had treated the FDNY evidence, right? That big document. Wanted to do the same thing, but in this case, TV coverage. And I was initially partly because I was sick, literally, and tired. I was pushing for a more modest project. Ted said, no, let's try and get it all. Let's try and get all the television coverage we can. I was going, oh, no. This.
I understand it was about 70 hours.
70 hours, yes, yeah. Of original footage from the day. Most of it continuous footage, not little snippets. So you can see the context. You can see not only the reporters that talk about explosions, but the ones who don't. So you're not cherry picking, right? So it was a good thing to do. And we split up the work, but I have to say on that particular article, he took the lead. Part two will be coming out in a few months, and hopefully I can balance out the work there. What did we discover? Well, I'm not going to give all the details. I'm going to give you the gist. The gist is that there were about 25 television eyewitnesses, and I'm just talking about eyewitnesses now, who had something to saw, who directly witnessed it and had something to say. And of those 25, 21 spoke of explosions and the rest did not, which means 84% of the direct eyewitnesses among the TV reporters reported explosions at the time of the buildings coming down. So what have you got? You've got in the among the firefighters, you've got 92%. Among the television reporters, you've got 84%. So we're probably on safe ground if we say that somewhere between 84 and 92% of the people who were actually standing there on the ground at the time these towers came down witnessed significant explosions. Ooh. And that's an important set of figures. And the other good thing about the TV reporting is that it's not just textual stuff here. Now we can actually see people. We can hear them. We can recapture what they were saying on the day. And if you have a little video compilation to play, Richard, this would be the time to do it.
Yeah, and it's striking to me that there there are 21 eyewitness reports, but there's also 22 narrative reports, right? They refer to the event as an explosion-based event.
Yes. Ted established these three categories, and it's quite useful. So basically, I've been talking about direct witnesses. There were also people who didn't, TV reporters, who didn't directly witness, but who had been told or assumed that the buildings had been blown up. Why is that useful? Well, it shows that in the early part of the day of 9/11, the dominant narrative was these buildings were blown up. The eyewitnesses said it. The anchors, and some says news anchors said it. The captions along the bottom of the screen said it. Everybody was saying it. So the idea that something different brought the buildings down is a revisionist hypothesis. It's not the original hypothesis. And that should be widely known.
And Graham, I mean, the FDNY, the Fire Department of New York, the New York Police Department, and the FBI, I mean, these are the three most important government agencies involved in the terrorist attacks. Well, should I say involved in
we know what you mean. The
Freudian slip.
Right. We know what you mean.
That was their working theory, for crying out loud. And yet later, something happened. But before we go there,
yeah,
figure out what happened, that this revisionist history happened, let me actually play some of these witnesses for our viewers, because this is absolutely extraordinary.
But as I was looking up, I saw the entire explosion. It looked exactly like the first two, but we certainly had the most perfect vantage point for that explosion. It was unbelievable.
There has just been a huge explosion. We can see a billowing smoke rising, and I'll tell you that I can't see that second tower.
We We're not sure exactly what happened, but it was another explosion on the far side of one of the buildings from where we're standing. The reverberation and another explosion on the right-hand side. On the far side of the building, there seemed to be another explosion, and also on the right-hand side. There was also another explosion. We're not sure if that was extra reverberation from what happened at the World Trade Center, but that was an added explosion.
We had a very loud blast explosion. We looked up, and the building literally began to collapse before us.
Again, there has been a second explosion here in Manhattan at the Trade Center.
Believe it or not, there was another major explosion. The building itself, literally the top of it, came down, sending smoke and debris everywhere.
Do you know if it was an explosion or if it was a building collapse?
To me, it sounded like an explosion, a huge explosion, a huge rumbling cloud. We're taking photographs and securing this area just prior to that huge explosion that we all heard and felt.
But it literally exploded and came down as though it had been hit.
We heard an explosion.
The explosion happened with shooting pieces of the plane. There are pieces of the plane on Church Street.
There's another explosion as we speak.
Something either exploded or fell at the side of the one building that was attacked.
Then the entire top of the building just blew up.
Just seconds ago, there was a huge explosion, and it appears right now the second World Trade Tower has just collapsed.
It was just a small explosion, and then rocks and debris and everything started pouring down.
We were about two blocks away when the second explosion hit, and all we heard was just this small explosion. Then we saw a roar of an explosion and all kinds of smoke coming billowing out, debris falling down.
It's unbelievable because you hear these explosions. In fact, I just heard another one. I don't know if it was like an after effect or whatnot, just while you were on the phone talking about the school closing. I'm hearing another explosion, just so you know. I'm hearing another rumble. And what you can feel when these tremors come is that it literally comes up under your feet. That's what it feels like. That's the best way I know to describe it.
Certainly didn't imagine that there would be second or tertiary explosions, so they parked some of their vehicles in those areas, and many of those vehicles, people in those vehicles, have lost their lives.
Well, we just heard another explosion go off a couple of minutes ago, Chris, and saw a bunch more people sort of running this way. A woman on her bike was screaming as it went off, and there was a New York City officer who's plain clothes walking by with a radio. I tried to stop him to ask what happened, and all he said was car bomb, car bomb, and then I couldn't trust him for any more information. He said
when the first tower collapsed, it was a massive explosion. When that explosion occurs, it was like the scene out of a horror film.
Another explosion, a rolling blast of fire, a rolling column of fire towards us.
You saw people being wheeled on gurneys away from the site of the explosion. I looked up, and that's when I heard the, pardon me. That's when I heard the explosion. That's when the second tower came down.
It was an explosion.
2 or 3 minutes ago, there was yet another collapse or explosion. And at 10:45, there was another collapse or explosion following the 10:30 collapse of the second tower.
I saw the explosion and also the collapse of the tower.
With subsequent explosions
explosions were coming down the building. It looked as if charges had been set on each floor and they were in succession going off.
He received word of the possibility of a secondary device, that is another bomb going off. He tried to get his men out as quickly as he could, but he said that there was another explosion which took place. And then an hour after the first hit here, or the first crash that took place, he said, there was another explosion that took place in one of the towers here. So obviously, according to his theory, he thinks that there were actually devices that were planted in the building. But the bottom line is that according to the chief of safety of the New York City Fire Department, he says that he probably lost a great many men in those secondary explosions.
Put us about a block and a half away from the site of where the explosion was. So their theory is that there may have been explosive device planted either in the building or in the adjacent area.
Many, many blocks from the site of the actual explosion where they now...
I was actually in the subway heading towards the World Trade Center right around Franklin Street. And after the first explosion, the subway station started to fill with smoke. The subway cars started to fill with smoke, and the subways actually stopped.
And I was walking on Broadway at Fullerton, and suddenly we heard an explosion. It was the first tower coming down. I started to walk out. I walked down Broadway towards Canal, and we heard the second explosion
covered in the debris and the dust from the explosion itself. I was a bit was rocked with a lot of the explosion from the force of the twin World Trade Centers when they came down.
I was out front as you were when the second explosion occurred, because the explosion threw debris on top of a lot of people. That was when the real panic began.
Sequence of crashes, then explosions, and then the collapses.
This must have been ground zero where this thing blew up. Car after car after car, buses completely obliterated and burned straight down to the steel.
That's the first time we're hearing that. So two planes and explosives that were in the building, is that correct?
That is the working theory at this point.
The first wave of rescue workers who went in were trapped, many of them killed by the second blast,
and escaped through the lobby, where they report they believe there was a bomb in the lobby.
I believe the bomb hit the lobby first, and a couple of seconds in the first plane hit.
Wow. Graham, that's just incredible testimony.
It really is.
There.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of the Mark Lane documentary when he's talking to his witnesses. You look at that and you go, so how could anybody dismiss all that? And the answer is they can dismiss it all through various propaganda techniques and because they consider these people worthless.
Well, how did this change? The dominant characterization on 9/11 changed what, the next day?
It had already changed on 9/11.
On 9/11.
Between the opening news in the morning and the closing news in the evening, the narrative had shifted from these were explosions to these buildings came down because they were hit by Islamic fanatics. And what this second part of the article that we're working on now will attempt to show how that was accomplished. How did they turn the narrative so drastically? What were the techniques they used?
To turn the narrative toward the fact, well, the theory, the
of
narrative
Al-Qaeda.
That planes impacting the buildings and the resultant fires weakened the steel and caused it to come down.
Right. So that's what we're working on now.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredible.
And I can tell you it involves both direct and indirect methods. A direct method is to plant an engineer talking to a major news anchor. And there's two of these guys who will say confidently why the buildings came down when they were hit by planes. And I don't know to what extent those guys knew what they were doing, but obviously they did not have anywhere near the kind of information you would have needed to be able to say the planes brought down the buildings. It took NIST years and millions of dollars to come up with an hypothesis, which was still wrong, but but at least it was somewhat serious. These guys somehow are able to come on TV immediately and say, oh, no, Aaron Brown, you don't have to worry about explosions and stuff because, you know, the plane hit very hard and it would have knocked out this and knocked out that and down they came. So yeah. That was one method. The people in your profession, Richard, selling their soul. The other,
I've seen a lot of that.
The other method is a bit more subtle, although maybe not. And that is you construct a narrative, a story, a good yarn, and you get all these authoritative people to come on the station in the afternoon, one after the other, who will repeatedly name the new perpetrator, Osama bin Laden, and it just becomes Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, and they will repeatedly talk about the story, which is that, you know, Americans are innocently sitting around in New York City when these absolute fanatics somehow learned how to fly planes. And the Islamic part of this is important because Don't forget, they used this to attack and destroy several Islamic countries. So the Islamic nature of the group they were blaming was very much part of the operation. And so they tell the story, the yarn of the evil attacker of the innocent American, and how, you know, Aaron, we're going to have to do some pretty hard things in response. We don't want to have to hit people, but I think we may have to do some bombing here, and there may be some casualties. In other words, they're saying, hey, they committed a state of war against us, which they repeatedly say. They committed an act of war against us. So we are now in a state of war, and we have a right to respond with war. We don't have to use the legal system or any of those namby-pamby things. We're going to go to war. Well, occasionally one of the anchors will say, yeah, but against who? And they say, well, we have competent evidence to believe that it's Osama bin Laden and that he's hiding out in Afghanistan. So that would be a natural first target.
And he's not even on the FBI's most wanted list.
Right.
For the 9/11 attacks.
I know. The whole thing is too silly. But he's the designated perpetrator, just like Lee Harvey Oswald and Sirhan. And what's his name in the case of Martin Luther King Jr.? Escapes my mind. Anyway, you have to have a designated perp. Sorry?
You got me on that one.
Yeah. You have to have a designated perp, and you have to mention them very early because you need to get in ahead of everyone else. And you have to repeat their name again and again and again and again and talk about their criminal history and their chronic hatred of the United States. So these are the stories that are being told all afternoon. And now the titles switch from things like buildings have blown up to Osama bin Laden said to be leading suspect. Now they don't have to come in and say, if Osama bin Laden did it, then he must have been able to bring those buildings down by banging airplanes into them and going through a structural collapse hypothesis. You know, they don't actually say that. You don't have to. As soon as you get people to buy the story, the attractive story of the evil outsider who attacked us on that day, then everyone assumes that somehow or other planes can bring buildings down that way. You don't have to argue.
An emotional narrative
absolutely
becomes a myth, and that's absolutely more powerful than facts.
Exactly what's happening. And even though in the morning there were people talking about what was going on, and those people had evidence, they could have appeared in a courtroom. They could have given eyewitness testimony to what they had seen and heard. And instead,
once again, it's up to you and Ted Walter to assemble the facts that the FBI failed to assemble, and NIST as well.
Yes, and then, of course, comes the challenging job of getting it out there to people who might care. Yeah. It's not easy, as you know. We've been working on this for years, but we know that persistence is one of the qualities you have to have in this work.
Well, I know there's a number of questions lined up for you, but guess what? I've got the first one and perhaps the toughest one. We'll see, because you have dedicated over a decade to assembling witnesses in these different arenas. There were lots of witnesses at the Pentagon event. Have you ever thought about putting your masterful skills that you've developed into that quagmire?
You want to seduce me into the shark-infested waters. No, it has been suggested to me. In fact, the first time was some years ago. A very sincere man actually said, you know, we're having some problems deciding what happened at the Pentagon. Why don't you do some of the stuff you did before on the eyewitnesses there? By that time, I had been kind of traumatized by that topic because I had seen the movement being torn apart by it. I was convinced that there was probably some infiltration going on. This was a possible way to destroy our movement. And even if there wasn't infiltration going on, I think we have to always remember we're not just investigating, we're building a social movement. And we're lost if we all fight each other. Mm-hmm. I've been in social movements before for years and seen them eat their leaders and fight and do all these things that groups do and lose their power. No, we can't do that. We have to maintain unity. How do we do that? Well, I am personally not going to get into the Pentagon issue. I'm not saying others shouldn't. It would be really good to know what happened there. But I've got nothing but grief from my few attempts to deal with it. And I'm taking care of myself these days, by the way. So
maybe I should listen to you and take care of myself as well, rather than to dive into those waters. We'll see. But let's bring Gail on and see what kinds of other safer questions we might be able to bring to you. Hi, Gail.
Hello, you guys. Hi, Graham.
Oh, no, we're having fun here, are you?
Yes, I am.
What are you discovering?
Well, there are a lot of questions. So, Yes, let me get started. This is from the first one I'm going to read is from Noelle. Mm-hmm. She says, today's media uses the term conspiracy theorists loosely when anyone questions the official narrative. And so far, not a word about the University of Alaska's Building 7 study from them. Can anything be done to unbias the media? And then this is kind of a two-part. And then she also asked after that, I can understand why the media in the USA might follow the 9/11 official narrative. But Graham, why does your country, Canada, not have a media mind of their own? Sanctions, trade deals, or what?
Right. Whoa, there's a lot of questions there. You have to remember that the major media in North America are deeply compromised. They collaborate with these narratives. That doesn't mean that it's completely impermeable. Every now and then you get a good, honest journalist, but the pressure on them is tremendous. Look what happened to Ashley. What was her name?
Babbitt?
No. She's there in front of World Trade 7
Automatic response.
A few moments ago.
Ashley Banfield.
Yeah. Ashley Banfield gave a public lecture criticizing, I believe it was the U.S. invasion of Iraq. She says she was basically confined to a closet for the rest of her time with that network. And finally, in desperation, got out and got a job somewhere else. So they have numerous ways to punish you if you don't adopt the official line, whether it be on war or 9/11 or whatever. 9/11 is considered verboten. I've talked to journalists in my own country about this, and they say my career would be over. And it's as quick as that, you know. I mean, the same thing about, I don't know about your legislators there, but in Canada we had a couple of, you know, during a major federal election, it came out that a couple of the candidates for member of parliament had attended, let's say, an AE 9/11 Truth meeting and had listened to the heretic Richard Gage, and who had perhaps briefly contemplated the fact that he might be right. Well, it was appalling to see what happened to them. They had to almost abase themselves and ritually apologize. And they both came out with little statements, which were almost identical. They obviously were written by somebody else. And it reminded me of the McCarthy era. It was kind of like, I am not now, nor have I ever been a conspiracy theorist. And it was a pathetic apology. I mean, I must admit I lost my respect for them very quickly because they should have stood up. But that shows you the pressure on legislators. They would not. Basically, the message there was that even though a wide percentage of the Canadian population thinks there's something fishy about 9/11, Nobody who holds that suspicion will be allowed in the legislature to represent Canadians.
Yeah.
It's like there's a big filter on the door. And media people are same, going through all this pressure. And I'm not doing that to excuse them. I think on the whole, I've learned that calling the media the Ministry of Propaganda is not too far from the truth. We see it a lot. So I don't know how to really respond to the question about what do we do about the media. I think the best method is to work on a one-to-one basis, get to know a couple of journalists, and don't go to the big media. Don't go to the New York Times. They're never going to listen. They're thoroughly, thoroughly infiltrated by the CIA. Go to small local places and have dialogues and chats. See if you make progress that way. Mm. That's the way I would do it.
Thanks, Chris.
There was something about Canada. Yes, there's all sorts of pressure that the U.S. can bring on Canada to get in line on these things. But I don't want to make it sound like poor little innocent Canada is being bullied. There was plenty of avid cooperation from our leaders and our military and our intelligence agencies. They all got on board with 9/11.
Yeah, and they're all on board with the other issue that's going around right now.
Right.
Yep. All right.
Even more so, actually, in Canada, right, Brett Graham, than the U.S.?
I would say that's probably true, yes. Yeah. You know, I'm pretty much, it's a system of segregation.
I actually have a curfew. I thought I heard one of our friends in Canada say.
Well, I don't have a curfew in my town, but that doesn't mean somebody doesn't. But I can't go and have a beer, and I can't go and have a coffee, and I can't go and have some food, and I can't get on a train, and I can't go on a plane, and I can't go in all kinds of different buildings. And now in certain parts of the country, they're trying to extend it to supermarkets. Imagine that.
Without a procedure?
Yeah, without some kind of procedure.
That's what Rutkowski calls it.
Surgical procedure.
Invasive procedure.
Yes, yes. So anyway.
Genetic therapy is.
Yeah, so I leave it to you as to how far we get into that one. But I would say to people, the same principles apply as applied in the three cases we discussed. Look at what ordinary people are experiencing, what they're perceiving. Are they being listened to?
Not the ones that are speaking out, not the nurses, the doctors.
Yeah. How about all the people whose bad reactions are recorded in the VAERS system? They're all being ignored. So the same principle applies. This is the deep state crawling out of the woodwork into the light, and we'll see whether the light destroys it or not.
All right. The next question is from Ray. He asks, there are witnesses to the sound of explosions in New York at the Pentagon and near Shanksville. When explosives were used in New York, can we conclude explosives were used at the Pentagon and near Shanksville?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't talk about Shanksville because I don't know too much about it, although it would seem that some sort of explosion or missile caused a crater in the ground. It certainly wasn't the plane going in. But as for the Pentagon, yes, I'm convinced that there were explosions that went off in the Pentagon. And they may very well have used a similar technique to the New York technique. In the New York technique, you did have planes hitting the buildings, but that didn't prevent you from having implanted explosions in the buildings. So they may have used a similar double whammy there, though I'm not taking any position now on what hit the Pentagon.
Yeah, okay. Great answer. So this is from Jean. Jean says, so the Times magazine, joined by several families of 9/11, filed suit. After a long process, the city was finally ordered by the New York Court of Appeals to release the records. Can Graham speak on that lawsuit? He would have known or been a part of it. Is that true, Graham?
I take it this is the lawsuit brought by the New York Times against the city of New York in order to get the World Trade Center Task Force reports.
I think so.
I think that's what we're talking about here. Yes. It was an important lawsuit. Without that, we wouldn't have this material. Some material was redacted as a kind of a compromise, so you'll get black lines on certain pages. But there's not too much of that. No, I wasn't part of that lawsuit, unfortunately. I wish I was, but that went ahead before I became aware of this. And unfortunately, the guy who led the way for the New York Times, I'm sorry, I'm having a bad memory moment here. I can't remember his name. He was instrumental.
Was that it, James Glanz?
No. Oh. No. But anyway, it doesn't matter. A guy from the New York Times led the way in this lawsuit. But once he got the material, he completely ignored all the material with explosions in it. And a lawyer friend of mine took him to task for that in a series of letters. And basically the guy wrote back that I must be nuts, Graham McQueen, if he thinks he found all this stuff in the material. And he wasn't going to have any further correspondence with such nutty people. And so again, we find somebody who's supposedly a major journalist for the newspaper of record, and he's unwilling to read the material that's in front of him.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know how you interpret that, but somebody is in, probably he's not an active collaborator, probably he's just, actually he's deceased now, that gentleman, but probably he was simply, I hate to use the word, but brainwashed into trusting his government and believing it worked as a functional democracy and that it would not be ruptured and ruined and smashed by anything such as a deep state. And he was wrong.
Hmm.
Next question.
We're going to have to scoot it along a little bit quicker.
Anytime.
Okay.
Let's throw him an easy one.
Okay. So this is from Clint. He asks, is Graham McQueen saying that the FDNY knew that WTC7 was going to be brought down by controlled demolition? So did the fire department know, do you think?
I would say I don't have a lot of evidence that a lot of people in the fire department knew controlled demolition would be used, but they knew that it was coming down, and they knew when it was coming down, within a few minutes, and they knew where to stand. So I don't know what to conclude from that. And we do have that one lieutenant, is it Rastuccio, who, when he's interviewed, who says, we have been told it would either come down on its own or it would be taken down. And then he says, I would assume it came down on its own. In other words, I'm not sure how it came down. It might have been brought down. So it was impossible for me in reading the World Trade Center Task Force report to answer that question.
Okay. All right. This is a question from Ray. What do you consider the most powerful explosion of that day? Which explosions made the loudest sound in your opinion? What are the loudest explosions you heard on video?
Oh. Interesting questions. I don't know what was the most loud explosion. You mean as in the North Tower as opposed to the South, or early as opposed to late? Some of the earliest explosions just before and just at the beginning of the collapses appear to have been very dramatic. And, you know, Richard, you gave an example. Material is shooting out in all directions. Big explosion. And then the thing starts to come down.
Yeah.
We also have lots of gunfire shots. I don't mean actual gunfire. I mean repeating explosions as the building's coming down. There are many people in a separate article that I wrote, the one about the South Tower that I quote at the end, and some of them say this was the loudest sound I ever heard in my life. Some of them compared it, quite a few of them compared it to a jet plane coming, approaching the towers. Many of them initially thought it was another plane.
Yeah.
So think about the significance of a sound like that, that loud. Others said it was like the subway that goes right over my head at such and such location in New York. Others said it's like a train, you know. And they keep trying to come up with metaphors for one of the loudest sounds they ever heard in their life. And this normally refers to the early stages of the Twin Towers coming down.
Okay.
And as far as, what was the other part of the question?
Let's see, which explosions made the loudest sound in your opinion, and what are the loudest explosions you heard on video?
Oh, the video question is quite complicated. I can't really analyze it properly. I don't even know what videos have been preserved, to tell you the truth. I think we've done probably a bad job of this. When I first began studying this material, there were all kinds of interesting videos of the towers, and there were some pretty shocking explosion sounds in some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But then you would see that same video image later with all of the sound scrubbed out of it. And I thought, well, I hope the heck people have been saving these videos. And I don't know, maybe AE 911 Truth saves them, but there's no general repository where they're all saved. And I've been nagged by several people lately to establish an institution that would do this, just like the Mary Farrell Foundation has, you know, like a million documents on its website pertaining to JFK and RFK and MLK and their assassinations. And we don't have anything like that in 9/11 Truth. And we're too busy to be preserving documents and doing essentially library work. We're above that. Mm-hmm. I think that's our feeling. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't done that basic work. And some people keep telling me, you know, that stuff is disappearing from the internet now. And the links in your article are all broken now. They don't lead anywhere. Mm. And so it's a complicated question, but there have been some in the past very good video audio of the towers coming down. And you can hear the successive booms. Boom, 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 boom. Very interesting.
Mm. Well, this is also from Ray, and it goes along with the sounds of explosions. And it's kind of an interesting concept here. Is there a compilation of all the sounds of explosions that were recorded on audio and video? Can these explosive sounds corroborate the sound witnesses describe? So is there a compilation
of all the sounds? There have been a couple of compilations in the past, but I don't have them. And I don't remember how good they are. You have to remember, it's not that easy for a camera positioned a long ways from the tower to pick up the sounds that people were hearing.
It's a real problem. I've heard from audio technicians quite a bit. David Chandler has done some interesting work with regard to Building 7 explosions. Mm-hmm. And showing that they are indeed on the video, but it is you have to have the right speakers and so forth. So they use that against us.
They do. So if we can have some audio experts, I'm not an audio expert, and I've been very careful not to get into this because it can be manipulated. All this stuff can be manipulated very easily. You need to have highly credible people working with it. So, for example, earlier, Richard, one of the clips you showed was of a guy, a reporter, standing in front of, like, which tower, I don't remember. And he's starting to say, the firefighters are assembled here, the police are assembled here, there are people dropping from the building. And just as he's going on like that, the whole top of the building turns into powder explosively. And he says, a huge explosion now.
Yeah. Raining debris on all of us.
Raining debris on all of us. We're going to have to get out of the way. And he runs. Yeah. Now you don't hear that much in that particular clip.
Yeah, right.
You hear perhaps a distant roar, but you don't heard probably what he heard. So how do we work out that problem? I'm not sure, but But there are a few big explosions, certainly, that are caught on tape, but not as many as we'd like.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is a question from Noelle. She asks, how far was the CNN building from ground zero? Aaron Brown was on the CNN roof and said, wow, huge explosion when Tower 2 started to collapse. How far was it?
I don't actually remember. It's all written down in my notes somewhere. Because you're right, Aaron Brown was on the building, and he told us where the building was located, and we can work out how far away it was from the towers. But I just don't have that on me right now, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
Aaron Brown,
110 yards from Building 7 to the North Tower.
Right. So, but where was Aaron Brown? It took me a long time to figure out where he was. Because CNN changed its location in New York a couple of times. We eventually, Ted and I, figured out where he was. But I'm afraid I don't have that right now. But he's an interesting character. I wrote a separate article on him, actually, called... what was it called? I can't remember my own articles. Yeah, it was something like "Don't be ashamed, Mr. Brown," because he was being interviewed like 10 years after 9/11 or something, and he was embarrassed. He said he was ashamed. He was embarrassed because it didn't occur to him that those buildings could have come down. You know, so he kept reporting on them, thinking that they were going to stand. Suddenly, they were down, and he thought, "Boy, I'm so naive. I probably don't even deserve to have this job because it didn't occur to me they could come down." So I wrote the article saying, well, of course it didn't occur to you. It didn't occur to any sane person before 9/11 that they could come down. You know, the firefighters were very clear about that in their testimonies, and nobody in their right mind ever thought those towers would come down. But there's Aaron Brown and his shame, you know. So anyway, I don't know what I was answering there.
Graham, you brought to light tonight the importance of witnesses and how they have been so mistreated, abused, neglected, and as you mentioned, a lot of them killed, in fact. And I think... the perspective that I have about witness has been deeply enhanced, and I appreciate your focus on this subject. It hasn't even been written up yet, and yet here we are, the recipient of a great deal of wisdom and gumshoe detective work too. I mean, we're so grateful to have you here. Do you have any other final thoughts for us? As we pack it up tonight.
Well, I would just say when people are asking, what can I do? It's kind of an obvious thing, but I'm going to say it anyway. You got to shine a light, because the deep state generally does not like to come out in the light. And what does that really mean? It means do some homework on this, get some facts, talk about it to people. Don't let it be forgotten. Don't become the annoying conspiracy theorist that everyone hates. You know, don't do that, because they can dismiss that. Be gentle, be rational, talk about more than one thing, but let it be known very quietly that you know perfectly well that Sirhan did not kill Bobby Kennedy. And when they ask you why, you have your evidence at hand. So shine a light.
Beautiful.
I like that.
And we'll keep shining our light too. Gail, you going to keep shining a light?
Absolutely.
Okay.
She's going to be helping me. And you've helped me so much over the years and a decade and a half, Graham. Thank you so much for being with us. And
well, Richard, you helped me a hell of a lot too.
Did I really?
Yeah, what's all this one-way thank you going on? Yes, oh, dear. You've been such a... kind of holding the torch for us all for so long. And I hope that will continue. So I'm honored to be on this show.
Thank you. My torch is getting multicolored, and it's going to be an interesting year, 2022. That's for sure, as we start marching forward into all these different areas. So, we will have you back. You've got anthrax to talk to us about and some other goodies.
I've got shaky tripods.
Shaky tripods. A lot of you don't know that Graham researched deep into the cameras, which were on tripods before the explosions. And guess what? They shook the tripods, which tells us what? When those explosions went off. We're going to go into that in detail in March. So join us back here. We'll let you know when it's happening. A lot is happening here at Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. Graham McQueen, thank you so much again.
Yes.
An incredible time of wisdom and knowledge tonight. And Gail, thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Gail. I'm deeply honored.
You're very welcome. No, thank you, Graham.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Email and support us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.
Hey, hold on. We got to play that right. Here it goes.
Thank you for joining us on yet another informative and soul-stirring episode of Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. We'll be on the air again next week with another very special guest in the 9/11 Truth Movement and beyond. Visit us at richardgage911.org, where you can find our schedule, learn about the WTC evidence, and, of course, sign up for our emails and support us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.